Okay, that's the second bell. It's time to get started. The guys are giving out tonight's handout. It's two pages again. So, we'll get close to finished. If you're missing ones, stick your hand up. We'll get it to you. All right, chapters 13 and 14 tonight in Genesis as we continue our study. Getting into the period of the patriarchs, started at last chapter, looking at chapters 12 through 50. It's been the time of the patriarchs. Excuse me. Okay, this slide here I've got in the front of the next several lessons, I think. We talked about it last time a little bit. Talk about the faith of Abraham and his obedience because of his faith. And looking at that and us, God made him promises. God keeps his promises. Abraham believed that. These people of old we read about in Hebrews chapter 11 acted because of their faith. And God has made me a promise. And based on my faith, I obey him and expect to receive those promises because of that. He was faithful and just, and he will keep his promises. So we'll see that slide as we go through several lessons to remind us of that. All right, let's review chapter 12 a little bit while they're getting the papers finished up here. The three promises in chapter 12 starts off with the promise that I will make you a great nation. And we've talked about that and the implications of that. A couple of chapters over, we'll get to in the next week or two, chapter 17. This is sort of a great nation, and I'll make you the father of many nations. Plural, and we'll talk about that a little more when we get to that part over there. And then we looked at Galatians 3:8, where it said that Abraham believed God, and it was just that the promise he gave him that the Gentiles would be justified by their faith, and he preached the gospel to Abraham. So we don't know exactly what he told him. It would also be the good news about Christ. So God said to Abraham something about the coming of the seed promise that would come there, and in you all the nations, again, plural, of the earth will be blessed through Abraham. Then we talk about the seed promise. I'll bless those who bless you. I'll curse those who curse you. And you, all the families of the earth, will be blessed. All that lineage on down through to the time of Christ and that blessing. So, with those two promises, in the first two or three verses of chapter 12, you see Abraham then, or Abram it is now, leaving Haran. Then he left Ur and went up to Haran. We'll see a map in a minute for that. And he's 75 years old now. He's got Sarai with him, his wife, and Lot, his nephew. And they come down to Canaan, the land he was going to. Didn't know where he was going. God told him to go. He got up and went. And they stopped at the city of Shechem. And so he leaves Ur down in Mesopotamia Valley, goes up to Haran, down to Israel, to Canaan, and he stops there, and our focus now is going to be on that area in the future. And so God now looks, he's in this land, and he says, this land I'm going to give you. I'm going to give to you and your descendants forever. We'll see those promises again tonight as we look through the class tonight. So that fulfilled, the end, this promise is fulfilled, at the end of Joshua, after the patriarch period, the Exodus, the wandering in the wilderness, the invasion and conquest, the way to conquer the land of Canaan. And God here said, I've given you all that land. I swore to give to your fathers. So looking at the map here, they stopped at Shechem, which is red in the middle. And then verse 10 of chapter 12, see a famine comes to the land. Abraham leaves here and goes down to Egypt to escape the famine. And there he makes a request of his wife, Sarai. She was beautiful. In fact, the verse says she was very beautiful. Abraham feared for his life. It was not been uncommon for then someone, the king there, or someone in power to kill him and to take her to be his wife. And so he feared for his life. So he made a request of her to tell them you're my sister. But if it's a brother and sister, they wouldn't kill him because wouldn't bother then. So we'll get to a little later on, and this same type thing happens again with Abimelech, and she finds out she really is his half-sister. We'll get to that in chapter 20. So we talked about last time, half-truth or half-lie? Well, half-truth, she was his half-sister, but it's also deceitful that it was wrong, it was a lie. So Abraham is treated well because Pharaoh takes Sarah in as his one of his wives, to be one of his wives, and treats Abraham well because of that, Abram well. And while he's being treated well, diseases and plagues come on Pharaoh because he has another man's wife here. He did not know it, but at times God gives him this to let him learn that. He learns the truth about her. He gives her back to Abram and says, go, you gotta leave, get out of here. And so they're sent out of Egypt. And we talked then about, we'll come back where they go in a minute. We talked then about Hebrews 11, verse 10. About Abraham looking and waiting for a city whose foundations, whose builder and maker was God. Talked about the fact he lived in a tent. He didn't have any foundation under him from that standpoint, like a house. But he knew God was going to build a house, a city that he wanted to be in. And talked about the fact that he never lost sight. He gave up earthly views. He went on earth because of a greater reward as he looked at that, at heaven with that. So we talked a little bit about lying and justification of that. The question came up, was Abraham justified in telling his lie? After all, she was his half-sister, and there was a good chance he'd be killed if he had been his wife, if she had been his wife. So was there justification of that? So when is lying justified? Here's the question. And the question I'm looking at here is, when are you most tempted to lie? When am I most tempted to lie? Well, is it when I'm threatened in some way? Like, somebody will kill me, maybe? Abraham was here. Would that be a temptation at times I might be tempted to lie? So that kind of summarizes where we were with chapter 12. Gets us up now. Abraham is coming out of Egypt after the famine's over and the plagues on Pharaoh and his wife back to him, and now they're coming back out. So he comes up then in the first verse of chapter 13 as we move into it. Comes up out of Egypt, has Lot, his wife, and he has Lot with him, and he goes into the south. This expression in some translations. Others say into the south. Remember the map I had last time about the desert, wilderness type area down to the south of the land of Canaan. The Negev is called there. That's what he's talking about, going up into the south. That's another name for that there. They come back up through Egypt to that territory there. And it's on these maps last time, going back to Bethel, which we've been to before. So he comes up through the south, up to Beersheba, and up to Bethel in the middle of the land up there. And then if you kind of get in your mind where that is on the map, then if you remember this map here we looked at, talking about Bethel. And remember the Jordan Valley over here? And this is the hill country up through here. The Dead Sea over here is about 1,500 feet below sea level. But Jerusalem up here is about 2,500 feet above sea level. So it's a major drop off from this mountainous region up here, where they are. And here's Bethel and Ai. He says he went back to the place where he pitched his tent before. So he's returning back to that land there, between Bethel and Ai. Of course, look at Shechem. We'll need this in a minute. So keep in mind where Shechem is. So here's Jerusalem, top of the Dead Sea, Bethel and Ai, and up to Shechem. We'll reference Shechem a little later on, kind of keeping your mind off where that is. We need to know that. So when Abraham comes back up, Abram, he was rich. You notice what it says in the text, he was rich in what? There's three things, I think. What do you have? Livestock, gold, and silver. Okay. So he was a very rich man. Jump ahead just a minute to chapter 14, which we'll get to a little later on. Think about a man here who had 318 trained servants ready to go fight in his household. Born in his house. So how large of an entourage, or whatever the right word is here, would Abram have? We have 318 trained fighting men born in his house. That'd be quite a large group that he moved around with here. So he was very rich. Blessed by God? Well, without a doubt. I mean, there's no doubt at all about that. So was he faithful to God even though he was rich? Well, the obvious there, the question is yes. We talked about his faith over and over and over through that. So he worshiped God in chapter 13, verse 4. So I asked the question then, are the faithful always rich people? Well, after that, we obviously know. So then the other side of that question is, are the rich always faithful? Well, you got to know again, right? So riches have nothing to do with faithfulness or not faithfulness or whatever. But look at these verses here about the rich. Let's just think about that just a minute. Abraham was faithful to God, even though he was rich. We'll leave it here in Luke chapter 18 that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter heaven. Because why? What gets in his way? His riches. And we'll get to the very next line, the love of money. And that's what we get in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Look at these words here that's highlighted. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Those things we have, food and clothing, we should be content with those. Gone away with the snare, made it foolish to harmful lust. The love of money is the root of all the kinds of evil. And some have strayed the faith because of their greediness. So money will pull us away. But Abraham here was a faithful man, even though he was rich. And in the standards of many people in the world today, we are quite rich from that standpoint. All right, we've seen this before. Let's get it, make sure we keep it in our mind. We're going to go back to it again several times here as you think about Abraham's history. So here's Abraham, the sons of Terah were Abraham. They hold a take to feed the livestock, the magic, Monday morning. Listen to this as I was walking. My slides are up here. Y'all's up here. I keep going back here. I'm sorry. But I read back out the wall. But Abram tells Lot that there be no, and in different translations have different words, no striving, no arguments, no contentions between us. Okay? That there be no contentions between us. And going down to the last part of the verse, and why? Why did Abram say there should not be contentions between him and Lot? Because we're brethren, okay? We're family. Or we're brethren. So think about that a minute. And then just think about our family. And they were a physical family. Lot was Abram's nephew. No contention among us because we're brethren. So think about husbands and wives. Arguing, contention, strife in the home. Or parents and children. Or maybe it's after the children get older and there's strife and contention and arguing between brothers and sisters. Does not this, what Abraham's saying here, make a little sense that shouldn't be there? Because we're brethren, okay? We're physical family, as it was in this case here. So a reason not to do that. There should be no contention between us because we're brethren. Was the very reason Abraham gave here for that. But then I got to thinking and taking that a different step and thinking about our spiritual family. There should be no sin, arguing, strife among us. Our spiritual family. Why? Same reason, right? Because we're brethren. So let there be no contentions or strifes or arguments among us here at this family. Why? Because we're brethren. Okay? And there's lots of verses we can look at to tie in with this. This is the one that came to mind as I was thinking about this. Ephesians 4:32, be kind to one another. Like the opposite of the contention or strife or arguing that's going on here. Tender-hearted, forgiving one another. And the reason it gives here for forgiving is what? Because God has forgiven us. And what does it say in when Christ was teaching his disciples to pray? Forgive us our trespasses as what? If we forgive others, okay? So we want forgiveness, we forgive others. And we've offered this sermon about this before, but this little verse caught my attention, and it's a point that I just have run across before, I guess, but let there be no contention between us, because we're brethren. And I thought it would come down, and we could get a little bit out of that tonight. So, Now they got to choose. So Abram comes up and says, "We're on discontention. We're going to separate. We go separate ways because of it." Now, who gets first choice? Who would you think should have first choice? Why would Abram have first choice instead of Lot? He thinks of logical reasoning why he should. He's the elder. He's the patriarch. He's the head of the family. Yielding to his wishes. So, but Abram doesn't do that. He's trying to get rid of the contention, the strife. He's trying for peace. So he tells Lot, "You take the first choice." Okay. The Lot chooses the well-watered of the Jordan. I don't know whether this picture is taken on the Jordan, but part of it, north, south, whatever. But I found it, at least it illustrates the point we're getting to here, of why Lot might choose this well-watered area for these large flocks he has. The green grass of the Jordan Valley down through there. I don't exactly know how that ties in with this, because we always think about this area here being dead and desolate around here, and this Dead Sea area down there, and they're in Bethel and Ai, so as it goes towards Sodom, actually Sodom and Gomorrah, the place where they thought they were before they destroyed, will be down here much lower than that, probably 30 miles south of that. So if he pitched his tent to the rich valleys here of the Jordan, perhaps, he's going to wind up down here, and it may be that there's more lush then. I don't know. But he did see the green grass of the Jordan, and he chose that. So that's the way he went. And he's going to wind up in Sodom because of it. So, well-watered plains. Lot should have said, "No, although you've allowed me to come with you. You've taken me under when my father died. Your choice. I'll take what's left over." But he didn't do that. He wasn't guided by his counsel of his father, his patriarchal father here, but took what looked best to him. So, seems though he made a choice based on what? Strictly could you see? That's right. Physical appearance. What can I see? I see these well-watered plains. I've got sheep that need to eat. I need sheep and livestock that need to be watered. That's where I'm going. So that Lot made his choice based on that. Didn't think about, perhaps, what might happen from those around him. Don't know what all went through his mind, but just a little supposing here. So then, that makes me think about our choices. Okay? If we make choices in life, do we have respect for those who might be older or brothers in general if we make our choices? Are we willing to listen to counsel? What if Lot had said to Abraham, "Give me some advice here. What would be the best choice for me? I see this good water and grass down here, but help me think this thing through." Well, we didn't listen to counsel. We're out for our own way. My choice is what I want. I trust my judgment. I don't need to ask anybody else. Or maybe in this case here, there was a false appearance. The green grass was there, but he didn't look beyond what was down there. There's the wickedness of Sodom beyond. Then think about the associations that might be around him. We make our choices based on that. We're not thinking about that. And just fail to consider the spiritual effect of our choices we're making. And sometimes it can happen to us, just like it happened to Lot, and that is almost a total ruin. We know what Lot went through, we'll get to that a little later on. Total misery because of his choice and what went through with that. So I got the comments. I'm doing a lot of talking here. Yes, sir. There is some There is some wisdom. There is some wisdom in younger people, because sometimes as we get a little older, our thinking power sometimes diminishes a little bit. Mine has. I'm not old yet, but I'm getting there. Each of us esteem others better than themselves. So Abraham is illustrating that, even back to this time here, by giving Lot the choice. If we look at it the other way, maybe Lot should have been doing that to him. All right, what's Lot's future? Well, we don't know that just yet. We do know from this chapter here that the men of Sodom were exceedingly sinful and wicked, not just wicked and sinful, exceedingly wicked and sinful. And so we have to kind of just put a little tag in here that says we'll pick up Lot later on. So we're going to jump off a lot for a little while here, and we'll come back to him and find out his destiny a little bit later. But Lot has left Abraham now for the low-water plains, and his fishing stand toward this wicked, wicked city of Sodom. So Abraham's left now, but the Lord appears to him. That's what he tells him. Now think about where they are. In the Bethel Ai area, that mountain range in the center of the country there. He says, lift up your eyes to the place where you are and look this way. Look north, look south, look east, look west. All you see, all this land, will give to you and your descendants forever. Right? Forever, worth forever. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But look at this land promise again that God's repeating to Abraham. All this land that you can see. Look to the north, south, east, and west. Forever. Forever can mean different things, according to Jesus. We think about eternity lasting forever. In this case, look at one commentator here. This is Adam Clark. He says, to the end of the present dispensation. The time's going to change, the dispensation's going to change here. We see another later on that's going to talk about this ending here being when the fulfillment of Christ comes, and then we'll get to that slide here in a minute. But forever, there's a lot of argument there. So the Jews now want to keep that land forever, forever and ever, based on these promises here. So then he tells them again about his descendants, his people. That's the land, and we'll come back to the people. You go out and count. How many children has Abraham got now? None. Okay. None. Go out and count the dust. How much dust is in there? If you count the dust on the earth, then you count your descendants. Which is, we know, a total impossibility. But walk through the land. This land I'm going to give you, and you're going to have descendants like the dust of the earth. So here's a slide of something about the very last phrase down here that we possess it until the manifestation of Christ in the flesh. Another commentator's way of putting it, when this forever will play out here. So that's kind of what's in chapter 13. Somebody got something that we talked about, left out, misrepresented, comments about chapter 13 somewhere. Let me see, Abraham coming back out of the out from Egypt, and then the split between them, and then these promises made again to Abraham, is the basis of what's in 13. We get to chapter 14, and we've got this war going on. There's a king up in the north, and we'll see how far north in a minute, Chedorlaomer, and he's got some kings, five kings down in the area of the Dead Sea down there, and the cities we'll see there we know about are Sodom and Gomorrah and Zoar. There's two others mentioned, but those are the ones that are familiar to us. He's had them paying tribute to him. It looks like 12 years, and 13th year, they're going to rebel. And so the little Mars going to do something about it. So he comes down and he reconquers some more lands. He comes down there. He's got three of the kings with him. So there's four kings from the north fighting the five king Elias from down in the south of the Dead Sea. And they come down there and there's the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and Zoar, this is one of these others that were there. And so they come down to get their territory back. Well, basically what came out of it was that those five kings down the south that rebelled lost the battle. And so as they, kings going back to the north, take all their booty, all their gain from it, they take Lot and his possessions with them. Because he's in that same area of Sodom and Gomorrah. So now, Lot's been taken off captive. The word comes back to Abraham about that. And this is where the 318 men come in. 318 trained men born in his house. That to me is just almost unbelievable to Abraham. I don't understand all that, but it's a large army, almost, if you will, here. So Abraham's got at his disposal here to go back and rescue his nephew Lot. So he goes to get him. Travels north to Dan, and then all up to Damascus. And he brings back then, he overtakes the kings, and he, 318 men, they defeat the kings. And he brings back Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people that come back. Now, let's see what that is. This little circle at the bottom here is Shechem. I showed you Shechem at the top of Mount Mulligan, when we're looking at Shechem south. Well, now we look at Shechem, look way north. And from Shechem up to that little circle at the top here is where Dan is. And that's the Sea of Galilee, in the middle of it up there. And then if you go off to the east and north further, you go to Damascus, the capital of Syria up there. That's how far Abraham went to get Lot rescued and bring him back. And I did a little rough calculation, 100 miles. He traveled up there to get Lot and bring him back. So, long journey, Abraham goes and gets Lot and brings him back in his possessions here. So when he comes back, he meets Melchizedek. Melchizedek, king of Salem. Now, most Bible scholars will say Salem is Jerusalem. The Salem in the word Jerusalem there. He's the king of Jerusalem. He's a mysterious type person. There's other things you read in a little bit there in the Bible about him. But he is at least this point here the king of the city, and he's also a priest. So he's a king and a priest. So from that and other things, we get the fact he's a type of Christ. Christ being both our king and our priest. So Melchizedek is a king and a priest. His name means king of righteousness, or righteous king. And the office he held here, in addition to being king, was that of being a priest, a prince and a priest. So he'd been at the bottom lines here, as Melchizedek, priest of the God Most High. And that's the phrase that's used there. He was priest of the God Most High. When I see Abraham, used the same expression used about Abraham a minute, about the God Most High. He tied the two together here. So he was in Salem, name Salem is means peace, or Christ is the Prince of Peace. Again, tying things together between the two there. So, Abraham's going to give Melchizedek a tithe. That's the first time I can think of that we read of a tithe anywhere if we come start through the scripture. So, he's going to give it to, and here's that phrase again, Abraham's going to give a tribute to the Most High God, or God Most High. The phrase there. Same thing is said about Melchizedek being the priest of God Most High. That's what Abraham said to give his tithe to God Most High. So he gives him a tithe of all. Now we don't read about tithe then when it comes a lot more. Then we get to the law given to the children of Israel. There's a reference in Leviticus 27. A tithe of all the land. Because the land's Lord was holy. Tithe of the herds and flocks, one tenth to go to the Lord, and these are the commandments that he gave them, give the children of Israel. They were two tithes, to give a tenth of all these things they had. Abraham giving a tenth or a tithe of these possessions he got in this battle to help his neck. So I ask the question here then, should we tithe? Think about it. Rather, our instructions are, I've got a couple of passages here from 1 Corinthians chapter 16, is that we are to lay by on the first day of the week, each one of us has been prospered. Or if you look at 2 Corinthians 9, it's your purpose on our heart. There's nothing said about a tithe, per se. But I didn't notice as I put these passages on the chart here, look the phrase that's underlined here. Okay. First day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside. Make plenty aside, so let each one of you give as a purpose on his heart. So all of us, Christians are to be givers, we're to give to God. Not a tithe, not a tenth, but as we prosper and as we purpose. So we got a few minutes left, and I got a couple of questions up here. Think about. You got some comments, I'll be glad to hear them here. I said, I taught this class, I think, to high school class, and so some of these questions are putting here for them. So the question is, what should, we're kind of finished the narrative here, because Abraham rescued Lot and brought him back, and Melchizedek. And by the way, we get chapters, we've got 13, 14, 15, and 16, 15, 16, and 17, three chapters from next time, 15, 16, and 17. So what should I give? When I'm a high school student, because I've got an allowance or a part-time job, what should I give? We were talking the other day about teaching children when they got their allowance, about giving. All this should be given to the Lord. Well, I'm a high school student and I have a job, or I get an allowance, am I going to give some to God? Now, a college student. College students have lots of money, right? College student. And what am I going to give them? Okay, son. Well, they are down at North where they have 80 or so college students in the congregation. He's taught that high school, that college class several times. Because he was talking to them about this point one time. I mean, the context. He was talking about college students. He said, what if each one of you just give up a Coke or whatever it takes and just $5 a week? Can you get $5 a week out of all the stuff you spend? That you really ought to be thinking about giving it to the Lord as a college student? Now, what responsibilities would you have at that point in your life? And then move on then, and I'm a young married man. I've got lots of bills to pay. I'm trying to start off in life. And I don't make a fortune yet. So, how to allocate my giving now? And then I move on, and now I'm midlife time. Gets in college. I got to think about retirement. So how much should I give now? And then I get up to the retirement time. Now I got a fixed income, limited income. I've got to save it for how long I might live out there, so I'm going to make sure I've got enough left to keep me going through my life out there. Comment somebody about that or anything else? That's the last slide I've got. Why through tonight? Fred is not here. He didn't say anything. I'll go back to Fred if nobody is. Anybody? at any point in life. Anybody else? Hard to hear from that side, this side, and this side, that side, but he said some of what Albert's already said, but he added one thing to it. What did God give us? Yes, sir. Talked to the college class a couple weeks ago, something like that. And we had after services on Sunday night and talked about idols. Our idols. Idols in our life. The things get between us and God. And we talk about money. Can't move that. What was the number? $800 billion, something like that. Credit card debt is in this country. Everything's bought on credit. What we put up. Yes, sir. Yeah. And I was looking ahead at some of the next two or three classes, and we got one of them apart. Some of that, I think, one of the lessons. But. Yes, sir. No, it's not for him, it's for us. Yeah, get my heart right. Yeah. All right, 15, 16, 17 for Sunday morning.